my journey in this film industry has really taught me to rely a lot on our Heavenly Father.
Brigham.
I'm here to collect Heber. We are going to England.
I know you're going to England, but not today. Heber is in no condition to leave immediately. Neither are you.
What's wrong with me?
He knows us so well individually, and he has a specific plan for you, for us. And by rooting yourself in your faith and your confidence in him, there's nothing really anyone can say or circumstances can do to change that path that he's created for you.
Let's rise up and give him a cheer.
Members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints represent a faith practiced by millions, a faith which has also inspired its share of controversy.
I think if you look at Brigham Young's whole life, well, it's a conundrum.
I'm Camry Bagley Fox, and together with John Wilson and Professor Daniel Peterson, we work to uncover unexpected twists in the character of a man that we thought we already knew. Dan, I've decided to replace Johnny with Janessa Sheffield.
Hello.
I think that's wise. It had to be done.
Yes.
Welcome. Welcome. I'm glad you could come.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here. I'll do my best to fill in as Johnny.
You'll do just
fine.
You'll
be great. Yeah, it's been really fascinating. I didn't know all that much about Brigham Young when I got brought onto this project, and it's been so interesting to understand more of all of who he was, right? It's been really enlightening, and it's been puzzling. It's
puzzling.
I mean, yeah, kind of all of it. Brigham's not a clean cut, easy to dissect character. You know, he's very forceful in some aspects and very kind and gentle in others. And so it's just been really, really interesting to get to know the whole of who he was.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons we brought you here. The Daughters of the Utah Pioneers is an old organization. It's been around since 1901. The building itself is celebrating its 75th anniversary. But they've been collecting materials, artifacts, documents, diaries, journals, all those sorts of things about the early pioneer period. This will help us to flesh out the story, what happened after those events in 1844.
Well, it sounds like an adventure.
I think it will be. I mean, look around just this room alone. It's a treasure trove of artifacts. There's just an amazing amount of information that's kept here. And Brigham Young was president of the church for 30 years. He had a long period, and a lot of his letters and documents relating to his presidency, his governorship of Utah, are preserved, and many of them preserved here. So we're hoping you're going to find some really interesting things.
Speaking of interesting things, a few weeks ago I did an interview with Lisa Olson Tate and Brittany Chapman Nash, who are church historians, and we had such a fascinating conversation about Brigham Young and his view on women. I would love to share that with you guys.
Especially in the 1860s, after plural marriage began to be well known in the East and in Europe and so on, Salt Lake City became a really popular destination for journalists, writers of all kinds.
A little sideshow of sorts to check out the polygamists.
It had a certain circus element to it, I think. And by the standards of the 19th century, polygamy, I mean, this is something expected from the harems of the Middle East, but not something you'd see within the confines more or less of the United States. So I think they found it kind of exciting in a sort of almost illicit way, but not quite. So people wanted to come out here and meet Brigham Young, the head of this weird operation out in Utah. After they met him, usually they'd go away with a positive impression, which I don't think they necessarily came expecting to get. I have a couple of examples here. Here are some quotations from someone who'd met him. He could philosophize with authority, if not polish, on Voltaire, and then make suggestions as to road conditions, provisions to carry on a journey, how to deal with Indians. I mean, it was this wide-ranging, very obviously very bright person who was not well educated, but had read, and but also knew practical details about life in the American West. And I love this one from Artemus Ward, who visited Utah and met Brigham in his 60s and described him this way. He noted his sandy hair, the clear, sharp eyes, the hard, firmly set lips, the robust health, pleasant face, and jolly manner. "The prophet is more industrious than graceful as a dancer," he wrote. "He exhibits, however, a spryness of legs quite remarkable in a man at his time of life."
I think it's interesting, in all the things you just read about Brigham Young, it seems like they are back and forth.
Yeah.
They're like firm-set lips, but jolly manner. He's very much two different sides of the same person all the time.
And that's what we're trying to understand.
But seeing Brigham Young in his 60s dancing, I would have loved to have seen that.
Don't we wish we had some video of that? But in the meantime, have at it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm excited.
Yes. Oh, come check this out. "I do not wish to complain of you without a cause, but at prayer time lately, I have noticed that one has been visiting, another has gone to see Mary, and another to see Emily. My family will acknowledge that my time is precious to me as theirs is to them. When the time appointed for our family devotion and prayer comes, I am expected to be there, and no public business, no matter how important, has been able to influence me to forego the fulfillment of this sacred duty, which I owe to you, to myself, and to God. My counsel, which I expect you to receive kindly, is to be home by 6:30 each evening, so as to be ready to bow down before the Lord to make acknowledgments to him for his kindness and mercy and long-suffering towards us. Your strict attendance to my wishes in this respect will give joy to the heart of your husband and father." What do you think?
I'm curious to hear your thoughts, because to me this kind of paints a picture of Brigham as I've come to know him. But I don't know that I would have always seen it that way. So what are your thoughts on this letter?
I think that it's interesting that he just didn't have a family council and address this in person.
Right.
He wrote it out. It was a permanent document. And I kind of seem strategic on his end.
To put it in ink, to say, this is important to me and I need it to be important to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For generation to generation to generation, or whoever else might come across it, like, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
Brother Brigham had some non-negotiables, and getting together at the end of the day with his family to say family prayer, no matter how busy, that's just something you don't slide on.
Yeah.
And I think that's great counsel as mothers with how busy we are.
Sure, to kind of make sure that the the gospel is getting incorporated into the daily life.
Yeah.
One thing I like in here that comes up again and again with Brigham Young is kind of the opposites that you see here. I hear in the verbiage his directness as well as his parenting with love, that he was a strict parent. And that was known of the Brigham Young household. It's like they were expected to uphold a certain standard. But all of his kids talk about how he was a loving father, and he talks about wanting to parent with love. But you see the kind of side by side here where he says, "I expect you to receive kindly," that he's like, you better take this the way I mean it, which is with love. And where he says, "Your strict attendance to my wishes in this respect will give joy to the heart of your husband and father." I just think it's kind of illustrative of who Brigham Young is as a human, that he's not just one of those sides, he's both of them. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here. It's always exciting to me when I get to interview women, and I get two at once, which never happens. So I'm really excited to have you guys here. Will you guys just introduce yourself?
I'm Brittany Chapman Nash. I work at the Church History Department. I'm a historian there.
And I'm Lisa Olson Tate, and I'm the managing historian for women's history at the Church History Department.
Love that. I'm so excited. There are a lot of opinions on Brigham Young's viewpoints on women and interactions with women. Obviously, the church has come a long way from where it was in the 1840s, and the world has come a long way from there, but we still see a lot of those things affecting women's daily lives, right? And so I think it's interesting to analyze Brigham Young from that point of view as well. We know that a lot of his views were pretty traditional. Were there ways in which his views of women's roles and responsibilities differed from the world at large?
Do you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. Brigham Young is a traditionalist. That's how I would describe him. And within his context in the United States, which was largely a Christian society at the time, I think he believed very much in 1 Corinthians, you know, the Christ is the head of man is the head of woman, which many would agree with at that time. And so I think he quite literally lived that out, believing that men were the leaders in their homes, the leaders at church, the leaders within their communities.
As Brittany has talked about, this paradigm of what we call male headship was the structuring paradigm that everybody understood and believed in. And so I don't know how to say this any other way, but they just don't really think of women as full human beings, right, in the way that we do today. They don't think about women having, you know, a full agency and a full personhood in the way that we do today. And that doesn't have to be overly oppressive or negative, but it is just the fact of the world that they live in. And even women internalize this. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody knows this is the way society works.
It was just an unspoken, it wasn't even articulated because it was so embedded.
In fact, when it starts to be articulated, when you start to see them making comments, that's an indication that there's some kind of pressure or questions coming up on what has been invisible and what has been, you know, just accepted as the norm. I think it's important to place Brigham Young there to begin with in the early days of the church. Brigham Young's views about women evolved over time. And so I think that's really important to understand. Again, with that traditional view and structure that they're all coming from, it takes some time and different circumstances for him to start seeing, oh, we're trying to build this community here. We're trying to have all of these economic initiatives and trying to be our own people. And he starts to understand that women can make really important contributions in that effort. Probably, let's just be honest, in large part from living in a house full of females.
Right. So I'd never really thought of the fact that Brigham Young lived in a household that was predominantly female. And I think that must have shaped his viewpoints in a lot of ways, because not only did he have more daughters than sons, but he's also living in the household with his wives as well, right?
And my guess is that even back then, they weren't afraid to speak up.
Right. One of the things we also talked about in the interview was how the plural marriage situation led women to step into these roles that were predominantly male, because their husbands might be tending to other families, and so they couldn't just sit around waiting for their husbands to do stuff. They had to kind of step in and take charge.
You're referring to the daily realities of farming, raising cattle, getting food on the table, even creating shelter.
Yeah, and I think while there are positives and negatives to the plural marriage situation, there were opportunities that these women had to lead the household in ways that they maybe wouldn't have otherwise while their husbands were away, you know, tending to their other families or dealing with various responsibilities that these women kind of became the real heads of the household.
Do you think that Brigham Young recognized that? Do you think that that changed his views on women's abilities?
I feel like it would have had to, right? I mean, if he's living so closely with so many women, I'm sure he was aware of the ways that they were stepping in and taking responsibility. I don't know if he processed it as like, oh, these women are getting to do these normally male roles, getting to or having to. I don't know how the women felt about it. You know, maybe they were like, oh my gosh, more work. Like when I think about the saints as they first came to Utah, I kind of think about like everybody being in plural marriages, which actually wasn't the case. It was only like 20 to 30% of them that were in these plural marriages. But that still really affected the community at large because it changed that dynamic, right?
Yeah, particularly if the women did speak up. Do we know if that was the case at all?
Yeah, I mean, we know at least with several of his wives that they were pretty outspoken. We see Eliza R. Snow a lot throughout history reestablishing the Relief Society and being very, very forward with her views, and I'm sure she wasn't the only one of his wives that was that way. So I'm sure some of his wives were very subdued. You know, it's not like that goes for everybody, but for sure there was stuff within the living situations that were positive as well as negative sometimes. I'd love to share more of that interview with you.
Yes, please.
I'm just curious because it's like one of Brigham Young's legacies, right? If you think of Brigham Young, you think of polygamy. How did that affect the lives of the women and children?
So I think it was transformative. At that period, you needed to be connected to a man to succeed, to have a smooth economic and legal and social life. It helped to be connected to a man, either as a husband,
father, brother.
Yeah. So all of those connections were essential. Women's rights were wrapped up in their relationship with men. And so in Utah, because of that system that was set up, a woman had to have legal rights of her own because she was often managing a household with a husband who was not there. And so we see an expansion of women's rights and their right to own property. If there was divorce, to have maternal custody of children, which did not always occur elsewhere in the United States. So polygamy was an important element that established sort of the way that women could move in society with a bit more freedom.
One of the ironies of that, right, is that there is kind of this expansion in property rights and availability of divorce and everything, but it's all kind of in service of preserving the polygamous system.
Right.
And so
it was necessary.
There's a lot of paradoxes there with the way that it played out.
I would love to hear a little more about the living situations. I don't know a ton about that.
The Beehive House is the official residence. Brigham Young's actual living quarters are there. And there's one wife, Lucy Decker, who lives in the Beehive House. She has 10 children, and she's kind of the keeper of this official residence. And then the other wives and children, again, not all, but most of them are going to live in the Lion House. And Brigham Young will come there for meals, especially for what they called dinner, which was the midday meal, often for breakfast as well. They could have as many as 50 or 80 people sit down to a meal. It was a tightly run ship, and the wives had different assignments, you could say, different stewardships, helping to keep the household running. Aunt Twiss, as they call her, is the captain of the kitchen, and she keeps everything going. And Lucy Bigelow keeps the big prayer room clean and does the dusting and cleaning there. So they kind of divide up the labor among the wives. But for the most part, the Lion House then is being run by women. Brigham Young is there, and everyone loves when he's there, and they defer to him, but he's not there that often or for that long. But there are a few of the wives that are especially known for their spiritual practices and their spiritual gifts. And so you have Eliza R. Snow, Zina D.H. Young, Lucy Bigelow in particular, who will get together and they'll have prayer meetings in their room. And the three or four, however many of them who come, I don't know, maybe they bring their children sometimes, they will sing, they will pray, they'll speak in tongues, they'll bless and prophesy and exercise the spiritual gifts that have been such an important part of Latter-day Saint women's lives. So there's a real center of spiritual practice and power that is part of Brigham Young's families.
That was really insightful. It helps me understand life, I mean, in Brigham Young's household, because majority of the saints lived outside of the valley.
Right. So there was the Zion hub and then the saints outside, which would have been pretty different culturally than being at the hub of plural marriage and all of that. And I can't imagine a lot of these saints had just come to Zion, right, and gathered with the saints, and things were starting to settle in as a community and living conditions were getting more comfortable and they're probably feeling like they finally have a home. And then they're asked to just like go elsewhere and you know, spread the gospel there and establish other living communities. I think that would have been very trying.
Yeah, their faith is unfathomable.
Truly. Join us for our next episode where we continue our discussion on Brigham Young and women.
Let me read you a quote from Brigham Young. He says, "Our young ladies should be taught business, and what do we know about it? We wish to exhibit to our community and to the world at large that we understand something about the rights of women." But he's saying this instead of having able-bodied men working in those capacities. We need them out in the fields.